The following podcast is brought to you by the Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
Good morning. My name's Bok Chu. Thank you for coming out on this drizzly, windswept morning. Today, I'd like to start a series of talks focusing on the four vows, more formally called the four great vows, or the four bodhisattva vows. My decision to give these talks stems from a recent realization. Recently, I noticed that I was just saying these vows automatically, really not thinking about what I was saying as I was saying them, just mouthing them. And I feel that that's a serious problem. Making a vow means setting an intention. If an intention is ever to be put into action, it cannot be created unthinkingly or repeated by rote. Conscious energy must be directed into the making of the vow so that energy can be directed in its actualization. In other words, we have to pay attention to our vows from the very beginning and all the way through, whether they are accomplished or not. If we don't do that, the vow has no meaning whatsoever. It's the energy, it's not the words. Human beings are very challenged to pay attention to anything for very long. This has been one of our biggest problems from the beginning. For that reason, when the 15th century master Ikkyu was asked to inscribe some words of wisdom, he wrote attention. And when this was not sufficient for the person making the request, he wrote it again and again. So we can honor EQ by paying attention to our vows. And that, making that kind of fresh start, is the primary reason that I would like to give these talks. According to Robert Aitken, the vows probably originated in 6th century China. But in fact, according to what I could glean on the internet, where all the information we have is stored somewhere, no one really knows when these vows were written or by whom. Probably they were written over centuries by multiple people. They were given heightened visibility in the West following Suzuki's 1935 book, Manual of Zen Buddhism, and his translation has really been the foundation of all the many different versions of the four vows that are used in the United States today. The first of these four vows is my subject for the talk today. In some Zen schools, they believe that this vow implicitly includes all other vows. In Japanese, the vow reads, Shujo Muhen Segando. According to Aitken, the literal translation is, the many beings, no limit, pledge, vow, carry a cross. And here at the Village Zendo, our translation is, sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. There are many versions, of course. On the one hand, the exact wording does not matter particularly. As I said, it is the energy. And on the other hand, the exact wording matters a great deal. So I'm going to work word by word through this vow. This version that the Village Zendo uses was probably used by Maizumi Roshi at least 50 years ago. So it has a long, distinguished history, and many of us have been chanting it for many years. This version of the vow starts with the phrase, sentient beings. Sentient means able to perceive or feel things. Given how often human beings misperceive things and have distorted attitudes about things, I think ascribing sentience to human beings is a bit of a stretch, but we'll give people that much credit for now. But of course, beings includes many other beings besides human beings, and in my opinion, it's these other beings that redeem the whole picture. What are these other beings that are not human beings, but that are able to perceive or feel things? Does a dog have Buddha nature? Is Buddha nature something dogs or humans can perceive or feel? Where do we perceive or feel it? The opening scene in a documentary film by Robert Gardner called Forest of Bliss shows three wild dogs in Varanasi, India. Two dogs are encircling a third, which has apparently strayed into those dogs' territory. And it is clear from the very beginning that that dog that has strayed where it should not have gone is not going to make it out alive. Finally, after much barking, growling, and pacing about, one of the two dogs who was attacking grabs the victim, let's call it, by the scruff of the neck so that the third dog can go for the throat. A few moments later, the screen grows dark. Fade to black. Sounds of a dog being murdered by other dogs. Unbelievable wails of pain and agony, which we cannot see on the screen. Which of these dogs might have Buddha nature? If you think you know, think again. Is it the good dog or the bad dog? Bad dog! We dogs perceive the rocks, the trees, the wind, the sky. We perceive garbage where it does not belong, and we put it sometimes where it does belong, and other times we put it in the recycling bin. We perceive an other, don't we? Someone outside, someone not us, someone who does not belong. And we attempt to put that person away as if they themselves were some kind of refuse. If you're wondering what I'm talking about, you won't have long to wait. But before I get there, let me ask, is there anything to perceive or feel? We think we know what beings are, what is alive and what is not alive, what is a thing and what is an animal. What is the difference between animate and inanimate, life and death? Would it bother you very much if I said that we have no idea what beings are? You might feel upset. You might perceive me to be full of crap. That's okay. Would it bother you if I said that from the beginning not a single thing exists? Not even so much as a speck of dust. If you stop making a thing out of things, you'll know what I mean. Returning to the first of the four vows, these dog, human, giraffes, tortoises are numberless. Numberless. Does that mean an infinite number? No number? Zero? One? Is the number farther than you can count? Whatever answer you prefer, where are these numberless beings that you are vowing to save? How do you tell where you end and they begin? There are about 25 people in this room right now, but it doesn't stop there. In counting ourselves, we must count the hospitals where we were born, if we were born in a hospital, the nurses and technicians in those hospitals, the obstetric instruments, the tiles on the walls, the taxis coming and going outside of those hospitals, people preparing food for all those people who were the forebears of those people. It radiates endlessly. There is absolutely no seam or gap anywhere in this picture. One rather well-known Zen teacher recently said, "Zen is the perfection of character." The perfection of character that I think he's referring to has nothing to do with our individual character. Although, of course, if we can figure out what perfecting that might be, and if enough other people agreed with the perfecting that we think that we found out, then that might not be a bad thing. But in my opinion, the perfection of character that he's talking about is the relationship between the individual, so-called, and the collective, so-called. Integration of the individual with a whole in the mind of the individual is the perfection of character. Yuan Wu, commenting on Longya's Mountains and Rivers, wrote, "An ancient said, the mind moon, solitary and full, its light engulfs myriad forms. The light is not shining on objects, and the objects are not existing either. Light and objects both forgotten, then what is this? Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Who is vowing to save whom? All the beings are in us, and we are all in them. Even if it were never known or acknowledged outside of this room, a vow to save all sentient beings is completely mutual, completely interdependent, unhindered. It permeates throughout all space, all time." Maizumi Roshi expressed it this way: "When I reflect on the vow of saving all sentient beings, I am actually reflecting about saving myself. Saving oneself is the fulfillment of the vow to save all sentient beings. Oneself has a double implication. The first refers to this limited self, this individual life. The second refers to oneself, this whole life as one. This expresses the very basic premise of Buddha's teaching, one is all is one. One mind is all Dharma, everything. This one mind, body and mind, is anything, everything." How can we actualize this vow? How can we realize Maizumi's compassionate instruction to us? 1/10 mile from here, straight down Broadway, there's a structure called Jacob Javits Federal Building at 26 Federal Plaza. The New York field office of the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, or USCIS, as it is better known, is located in this building, as are offices of various other federal agencies. It is in the offices and courtrooms of the USCIS that the fate of dozens of immigrants is decided upon weekly. People petition for refugee status and asylum so that they can remain in this country. Many of these people entered the United States illegally, and their presence in the country is a subject of an official process geared very much toward their deportation. Deportation is the government's goal, and it takes quite a lot to stave that off and to allow these people to remain here where, for the most part, the vast majority are doing nothing more than living their lives and trying to keep their families together, trying to keep their lives together. A few days ago, I entered 26 Federal Plaza in order to accompany a man named Elias. Who had what is referred to as a master calendar hearing. Scheduled for 10:30 in the morning, I was performing this accompaniment under the auspices of the New Sanctuary Coalition with two other volunteers. My role in making this accompaniment, my first, was to support Elias and to bear witness to the immigration process without voicing judgments or opinions. To not ask him any questions, to not find out anything about him, to simply be present to the process as it unfolded. And let me tell you, on all levels, that was an incredibly difficult assignment. I have a lot of judgments and opinions. Sentient beings are numberless. Elias arrived late because he had to travel about 2 hours to get to the hearing. Many immigrants live quite far from where their cases are adjudicated, and these hearings are an incredible burden on them since, of course, they get no pay when they do not work. When they have to travel and spend an entire day sitting around and waiting for a hearing, it's extremely burdensome. But whatever the disruption and strain, they are absolutely compelled to go to these hearings or they are subject to immediate deportation. Elias was a small man. He looked to be in his mid-20s, and he did not come to the hearing alone. He brought his 6-year-old son with him. The boy was sick. He was running a fever, and he was very uncomfortable throughout the whole process. It was his presence that made the experience especially affecting to me. During the 3 hours I spent in the company of Elias, his son never left his side. He would not even consent to sit in a chair next to Elias. He had, at all costs, to be held by Elias, whether in his lap or draping himself over his legs. He would not let go. So we can see from this very simple illustration how incredibly painful these family separations that are occurring must be, and how barbaric it is to separate children from their parents under any circumstance. How damaging and cruel. I grew up in a prosperous Midwestern suburb. My parents provided me with a comfortable home, clothing, books, food, and even, at a fairly tender age, guns. There seemed to be money for pretty much anything that was needed, but the kind of physical closeness that I saw between Elias and his son was not a prominent feature of my upbringing. So here were these two people in imminent danger of deportation with very little to call their own, living under great strain and in relative poverty, let's say, who had something that I never had, something that has shaped my life ever since. It was heartbreaking, really heartbreaking, to wait for hours in that crowded, drab room for Elias to have his fate decided, or at least the initiation of the process to decide his fate. Looking at that sick little boy squirming in his father's lap, I fought back tears many times. So, what does saving numberless sentient beings have to do with this experience? Was I accompanying one person, two people, Millions? Whatever their numbers, what was their relationship between, what was the relationship between them and me? Who was saving whom? My own grandparents were immigrants. And if it wasn't for their decision to trek across Europe, I would never have known that such a place as Federal Plaza existed. I would never have accompanied Elias. I would not exist. Whatever I is, whatever exist means. And now we come to the toughest part of the vow for me, the saving. What does saving mean in this situation? What would it look like? On one level, the first of the four vows means enlightening all sentient beings. If we go back to Aitken's literal translation, the phrase carry across expresses that. We are carried across from delusion to enlightenment. The other shore. But I felt like I was being enlightened. I was being given a real experience of our barbaric immigration system. A system supposedly set up for my protection and at my expense. So on that level, I was being carried across from ignorance to a glimmer of real insight. I was being saved. While he was being oppressed by the US government, Elias was carrying me to the other shore. He carried me just as he carried his son. He carried me. The generosity of Elias in that situation was staggering. But my thoughts, of course, naively tended the other way, to the question of how I could possibly save Elias and his son from the horrible machinery in which they were enmeshed. They didn't speak English, and I don't really speak Spanish. And in any case, I was directed not to engage them in needless conversation. As I sat there with them, I felt absolutely powerless. My powerlessness rose up before me like a mountain, inescapable and overwhelming. In fact, though, I was not there to fix anything. Certainly not in the ordinary sense of fixing. It is hard to say what saving is, but I think I can say that it is not fixing. Not fixing other people or other situations, not even ourselves. With our distorted attitudes, our cramped points of view, how could we possibly know, how could we flawed beings possibly engineer some sort of fix anywhere on this planet? We are so deeply flawed that we do not even realize that we are already perfect and complete, just as we are. Even the great Hakuin was moved to say, I feel like a physician who possesses a wonderful knowledge of medicine but has no effective means of curing an actual sickness. How can I possibly hope to rid other sentient beings of their afflictions as long as I still suffer from illness myself? But there is something healing something integrating to bearing witness while withholding judgments and opinions. It is a most arduous and uncomfortable practice. I cannot recommend it too highly. I was in that waiting room to experience the full extent of my powerlessness and to find the strength to tolerate it. I was also there to see how unbelievably privileged I am and how many blessings I, the grandchild of immigrants who came to this country with nothing almost 100 years ago, how many blessings I have received. I left 26 Federal Plaza before Elias's hearing, so I don't know anything about what might have happened to him that day or to his son, since my Spanish is so poor. Any words that I could possibly have said in parting would have never adequately expressed my feelings at that time. All I could do is make a heartfelt bow in their direction and shuffle off. Down the corridor, lined with other people waiting for their hearings, and out into the street below, a free man. I was doing what they could not do. When will they be able to do it? This is just one way to actualize what my Zumi Tetsugin, who is on our altar, memorialized now, and Enkyo Roshi, who is here with us now. This is just one way to actualize what they have taught us so many times, pointed to, lived by so many times, in so many ways, for so many years. There are numberless ways to follow this way of saving numberless beings. Visit a sick friend, if they're okay with the visit. Pick up trash on the street and don't put it in the recycling bin. Don't talk on your phone or text while somebody's serving you or ringing up your purchase. Give them your attention. Hold the door for somebody coming in behind you. Or even stand aside once in a while and let them pass first. Really pay attention as you straighten your cushion after this talk. I'd like to close with a quote by Thomas Mann. I bear within me the seed, the rudiments, the possibility of life's capacities and endeavors. Where might I be if I were not here? Who, what, how could I be if I were not me? If this outward appearance that is me did not encase me, separating my consciousness from that of others who are not me. An organism of blind, rash, pitiful eruption of the insistent assertion of the will. Far better, really, if that will were to drift free in a night without time or space, than to languish in a prison cell lit only by the flickering, uncertain flame of the intellect. Blind, rash, and pitiful eruption that I am, I can save all sentient beings. Join me in really paying attention as we say the four vows. Chant them like you mean it. Thank you.